American consumers are not the only ones in trouble with debt right now. Turns out the stores where people have been buying all that stuff are in trouble, too. And this morning, we'll continue our conversations on debt with a look at retailers. It's getting harder for some stores to pay off their loans or to get new ones. That's according to Howard Davidowitz, a retail consultant in New York, who is forecasting a terrible year for stores.
We're going to close 7,000 stores in America, a record, because last year we closed about 4,500. And we've got maybe 15 retailers beyond those who've already announced bankruptcy on the edge or close to the edge. So we've got a very difficult situation in the retail business. Debt is up 30%, and just like consumer debt is up, corporate debt is up, everybody's debt is up. It's a real danger.
When you talk about 7,000 stores closing this year, those range, I suppose, from mom-and-pop individual stores to entire chains going under?
Yes, it does. Like Bombay is closing all of their stores. Friedman's just announced they're going to close all of their stores, 350 stores. Ann Taylor is closing 130 stores. Wilson's Leather closing over 100. Charming Shops closing over 100. Levitt's closing all of their stores. Kirkland's closing over 100 stores. CompUSA is closing all of their stores. There's a tremendous number of stores closing across America.
Is this just that Americans are spending a little less?
Well, it's a combination. First of all, Americans are spending less. They've got the highest debt they've ever had. They've got tremendous inflation. Americans used to spend 10 cents on food and energy. They're now spending about 17 cents on food and energy.
10 cents out of the dollar that consumers had, and now it's 17 cents out of the dollar on food and energy?
Yes, sir.
But it sounds like you don't think that consumers spending less is the only problem that stores have right now.
No, stores have a host of problems. One, we're overstored in America. We have 19 and a half square feet for every man, woman, and child in this country, and we need 10. So we have too many stores.
Who decided that 10 square feet of store per person was the appropriate amount?
Interesting question, and I'll tell you how I came up with it. It was developed by me. What I did was take the number of stores that closed and why they closed. Almost everybody closed because of too much competition. What happened? Walmart came along and closed them down. The consumer made a choice to choose Walmart. Their prices were lower, the stores were bigger, blah, 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 blah. But the point is, if all of this competition didn't develop, these guys would have been fine. They were in business 60 years and they all collapsed.
Is there also a problem with stores that have their own debts that they're having trouble paying?
You're absolutely right. Retail debt is up 30%. It's exploded. Now, it's a combination. Some retailers have a lot of debt, and they're not in trouble. If you take Six Flags, a huge amusement retailer, they've got a $2.7 billion debt load, but they're able to handle it. Blockbuster has a $700 million debt load. They're up to handle it. Other retailers are in danger, be it Linens and Things, Talbots. There's a lot of people in trouble with their debt. This is a terrible time to be dependent on bank debt and be in trouble because the banks will be unmerciful.
Are a lot of those retailers that are in trouble in situations where they sometimes need to get an extra loan or line of credit just to get through a bad month?
Yes, I would say not a bad month, certainly a bad season. If you need an extra line of credit to get through a bad month, you're already finished. But yes, there are retailers whose line of credit are being taken away because A, they're in default, or B, the line of credit has expired. Talbot's is in default. They've got to put something in place so they can order merchandise for next year. My hunch is the Japanese, who are the major owners, will step in and help them. But if they don't, Talbot's life could be at stake.
Oh, because if you're a storekeeper or a chain owner, you're probably going to buy your merchandise on credit and promise to pay people back later. You're borrowing money all the time.
Yes, sir. You're borrowing money all the time.
Well, that raises the next question then. Are there retailers that have a fundamentally sound business model who are basically making money, but they do need to borrow for inventory from time to time, and because of the financial mess, they're suddenly unable to borrow and unable to do business, even though it's a sound business?
Absolutely. There are many retailers out there, Pier 1 and a whole list of them, who maybe could operate okay if they got some forbearance. But it's a terrible time to be dependent on bank debt.
Well, this raises one more question then. If, in fact, There are 19 square feet of retail space for each person in America, and in your view, there really ought to be more like 10. And if we are going to see thousands and thousands more store closings, what kind of business can anybody do with all those empty shopping malls?
Excellent question. A lot of shopping malls are closing as we speak, and they're being used as alternative uses. For example, they're building hospitals. They're building hotels. They're building condos. They're building all kinds of things. The problem is we might not do more retail.
Howard Davidowitz, thanks very much.
And thanks so much for inviting me.
And we'll continue our conversations about debt tomorrow when we'll look at auto loans, which Americans are finding it harder to pay.
People have been sold the American dream, which is a beautiful, sexy, hot car that's going to make everybody envy them. And now they're sort of paying the price for making a poor decision.
In another part of the country, scientists are trying to check the spread of a disease. It's called white nose syndrome, and it could wipe out some species of bats in the Northeast. Brian Mann reports from North Country Public Radio.
A little over 3 months have passed since researchers first confirmed that white nose syndrome was infecting bats in Massachusetts, New York, and western Vermont, killing 90% of the animals in some caves. Biologist Susie von Ottingen with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says they've made little progress understanding the disease.
We are still in the dark with what this is.
Scientists were hoping that the outbreak would be limited to small pockets of remote caves, but a rash of newly infected sites, including caves in Connecticut, has killed much of that optimism. The fear, says von Ottingen, is that white nose is spreading toward core habitats as far away as Ohio and Virginia and could decimate crucial populations of endangered Indiana bats.
If we knew that it was an environmental factor that was unique to the Northeast, then maybe we wouldn't have to be concerned. But because we don't know, we really do have to watch those adjacent states very closely.
Scientists don't know that much about the diseases that affect bats. Some of the dying animals exhibit a crust of white fungus on their noses, but others simply look emaciated or disoriented. While researchers scramble to dissect hundreds of infected bat carcasses, volunteers have been enlisted to see if some of the ailing animals can be kept alive.
When we get the bats out, we have to weigh them, so we put them in a little dish like this one.
Kathy Lara was an amateur wildlife rehabilitator in Hudson Falls, New York, an hour outside of Albany. Sitting in a bedroom in her home that's been converted into a makeshift clinic, Lara is preparing to feed a tiny bat.
So we got to get some extra food into him. They're all been tagged. But you sit here and they should eat 6 to 8, either mealworms or grubs.
Two of Lara's bats have already died. Three others seem to be gaining strength. Environmentalists say volunteer efforts like this one are a sign that government agencies haven't moved fast enough to protect these animals, especially endangered Indiana bats. Despite the rapid spread of white nose syndrome, the Fish and Wildlife Service still hasn't appointed a full-time staff person to coordinate the response. Earlier this month, a coalition of green groups threatened to sue the federal government under the Endangered Species Act if more isn't done. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann in northern New York.
I'm just downloading this video that shows an abandoned mine in New York State where bats live and die mysteriously. You can get a look for yourself at npr.org. Okay, here's something to imagine, a sports calendar that makes sense. Our commentator Frank DeFord says some sports schedules remind him of a certain character.
Did you ever talk about Nutsy Fagan around your neighborhood? When somebody acted, well, Nutsy, we said he's as Nutsy Fagan. There's some question who exactly the Nutsy Fagan was. He might have been a guy in the 19th century New York who liked to join funeral processions under the impression they were parades. And, of course, we weren't so considerate then. Guy was fat, we called him Fats. A guy was Nutsy, hey, we called him Nutsy. Anyway, I always think of Nutsy Fagan when I see how some sports handle their schedule. For example, the most important NASCAR race is the Daytona 500, first big race of the year. It would be as if the NFL started with the Super Bowl and worked backwards from there. The two most different surfaces in tennis are clay and grass, but as soon as the French clay championships end, they immediately switch to grass and start Wimbledon only 2 weeks later. Only Nutsy Fagan could have dreamed that up. College football teams finish their regular schedule in November, maybe early December. Then the two championship contenders take a whole month off before meeting for the national title in January. Nothing, though, is so dopey as the way horse racing conducts its premier event, the Kentucky Derby, which, of course, is run this Saturday by custom, the first Saturday in May. In how many details can they screw it up? Let me count the ways. First of all, the Derby is run at a mile and a quarter, which is a long distance for young three-year-olds to cover. Thoroughbreds race a lot less now, and they're bred for more speed, too. As if running the mile and a quarter early in May isn't asking too much, the second leg of the Triple Crown, the Preakness, will be conducted in just 2 weeks' time. And not only that, the Preakness is shorter than the Derby. So they run the longer race first, then rush into the second, shorter one. Then just 3 weeks later comes the Triple Crown finale, the Belmont. That means the three races are jammed together in only 5 weeks. Big Brown, the probable Derby favorite, has so far only raced three times in his whole life. The Belmont is run at a mile and a half. This is a distance virtually no racehorse in America runs anymore, except for the Belmont. But to make it sound special rather than idiotic, a mile and a half is always called a classic distance, which is true enough, especially if you think classic means out of fashion. The Belmont is classic the way the set shot in basketball is, but of course nobody in basketball is dumb enough to use a set shot anymore just because it's classic. Moreover, at the Derby, to start the Triple Crown off, they let 20 horses run, which is far too many. So the most important race in America is more determined by luck than skill as the thundering herd blasts out of the starting gates. No wonder no colt ever wins the Triple Crown anymore. So Saturday, when the band starts playing My Old Kentucky Home and the Thoroughbred Stampede comes onto the track, I always raise my mint julep and say, "You did it again, Nutsy Fagan."
Commentary from Frank DeFord, who shares his mint juleps with us every Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Stephen Skip. This is the kind of thing you expect to happen in some unstable foreign country or in an old movie. You're traveling within a country, yet you come to a checkpoint and someone says, "Your papers, please." It's happening in more of the United States. The U.S. Border Patrol is checking the citizenship of passengers on certain ferries that travel the waters inside Washington State. Such checks are common in the Southwest, but along the Canadian border, they're relatively new. And as NPR's Martin Costi reports, the checkpoints have come as a shock to many people.
This is a Washington State ferry running from Friday Harbor on San Juan Island to Anacortes, a town on the Washington State coast. This is a purely domestic route. We never leave U.S. waters. And yet, when we arrive in Anacortes, there's a decent chance that we'll be greeted by the Border Patrol.
"We're asking you your nationality and citizenship."
Joe Giuliano is on the phone. He's a Border Patrol spokesman, and he's walking me through what might happen if there's a checkpoint when this ferry docks.
"If you have no paperwork with you, then we either have to be convinced by you or run some other records checks, either on your vehicle or the name you give us, to attempt to validate that."
Washington State San Juans are a cluster of picture postcard islands known for small farms, B&Bs, and whale watching. They also happen to be very close to Canada, close enough that an illegal immigrant or a smuggler might kayak across and then take a domestic ferry to the U.S. mainland. The Border Patrol says that's why it needs to have a choke point at the Anacortes dock.
"All passengers must disembark the vessel upon arrival."
Although today it looks like there won't be any checks. They're letting us straight off the ferry. Passenger Vinnie O'Connor is relieved not to have to stop and attest to his citizenship. Does it bug you in any way to have to answer that question?
"Well, if it bugs me, I'm not going to say anything. I want to get through the line and get in my car and go home."
It certainly bugs some people. William Ginzik, who lives on Orcas Island, encountered the checkpoint for the first time a couple of weeks ago.
When we got there, there was this big guy. Came over to the car. I rolled down the window. He says, "Oh, you're American. Go ahead." The hysterical part about all this is my wife is a French citizen.
Upset Islanders even called in a Seattle immigration lawyer, Matt Adams, director of an organization called the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project. He came out and gave them a mini legal seminar.
They can ask you where you're from. They can ask you to show your papers or to show your driver's license or to show your birth certificate. But you don't have to provide that information.
He says because this isn't a checkpoint on the border, people do have a greater right to privacy.
What I suggest to individuals is to politely refuse to answer questions, and then if they still don't let you go, to say, "Am I under arrest? If I'm not under arrest, I would like to continue on my way."
There have been a few protests. A couple passengers tried answering the citizenship question by flashing American flags they'd painted on their wrists. They were just delayed. But for illegal immigrants, the stakes are higher. On San Juan Island, an illegal immigrant from Mexico watches the ferry arrive. Asking not to be identified, she says she no longer dares to go off island.
If you go off island and you don't have all the family with you and you get stopped there, you're going to get deported. And what about the rest of your family?
She says she feels trapped, but not everyone here is sympathetic. Chris Clark is a longtime Friday Harbor resident.
If you do something willfully and say, "I'm not going to pay attention to this law," and then that law catches up to you, then the right thing to do is accept the consequences.
Clark is annoyed at fellow islanders who oppose the checkpoints. He says the number of illegal immigrants on the islands has jumped in the last decade or so. Some locals complain about being undercut by illegal workers, especially in the landscaping business. Border Patrol spokesman Giuliano says it's high time enforcement caught up.
The Border Patrol presence on the northern border was not really what we would have liked it to have been for a great many years. And in the wake of 9/11, we're starting to get resourced up, and we're finally reaching that point where we're doing these things that, in all honesty, we should have been doing all along.
Many locals acknowledge that border security probably needs to be tighter. But on these cozy islands, higher security still comes as something of a culture shock. Howie Rosenfeld, chairman of the county council, tries to explain the feeling.
It's a visceral thing. It just seems like we're not the free and brave country that we were. We seem to be sinking into some sort of a fear-based society.
Rosenfeld says he plans to cooperate with the checkpoints, but he hopes it's not something he'll have to get used to. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
Yesterday, we brought you a story about Poetry Out Loud. That's a national recitation contest. This year, about 200,000 high school students competed. And last night, 12 finalists faced off for the national championship, reciting by memory poems by Edna St. Vincent Millay, Martina Spada, and Kathy Song, among others.
And now we bring you the winner, Shantae Henry of St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands. Here's Ms. Henry with the poem Frederick Douglass, written in the middle of the last century by Robert E. Hayden.
When it is finally ours, this freedom, this liberty, this beautiful and terrible thing, needful to man as air, usable as earth, when it belongs at last to all, when it is truly instinct, brain matter, diastole, systole, reflex, action, when it is finally one, when it is more than the gaudy mumbo jumbo of politicians, this man, this Douglas, this former slave, this Negro, beaten to his knees, exiled, visioning a world where none is lonely, none hunted alien. This man, superb in love and logic, this man shall be remembered. Oh, not with statutes, rhetoric, not with legends and poems and wreaths of bronze alone, but with the lives grown out of his life, the lives fleshing his dream of the beautiful, needful thing.
Shante Henry, reciting the poem Frederick Douglass by Robert E. Hayden. Yesterday, with that performance, she became the national champion of this year's Poetry Out Loud competition.
Willie Nelson turns 75 today, and to honor him, Little Brown is releasing a major biography called Willie Nelson, An Epic Life by Joe Nick Petoskey. And Sony Legacy has issued a 4-disc box set that spans Nelson's entire career. Our rock historian, Ed Ward, has seen Nelson in concert and interviewed him many times and has even helped sing backup vocals on one of his albums. Today, Ed looks at Willie Nelson, the songwriter, whose career preceded Willie Nelson, the superstars, by a couple of decades.
On the road again, just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again.
This is the Willie Nelson most of America knows. Picking his old Martin guitar, accompanied by his ragtag band, rolling down the highway in a cloud of pot smoke, outlaw country music in person. But the Willie Nelson I first became aware of in the early 1970s was someone else entirely, a Nashville songwriter with a unique lyrical and musical gift. William Hugh Nelson was born in Abbott, Texas in 1933 to a musically inclined couple, Ira and Merle Nelson, who already had a 3-year-old daughter, Bobby. Abbott's cotton country, and there's not much to do there, so Bobby learned piano, and Willie was writing poems by the time he was 4 years old. Mostly, they were sad, maybe because his mother had left when he was 6 months old and his father wasn't around much. When Bobby was 16, she married a guy named Bud Fletcher, who had a Western swing band. She played piano, and 13-year-old Willie signed on to play guitar, and almost immediately he had a fan club. He fell into the life of a professional musician and made his first recordings as a guitar player in 1954 in San Antonio. He had a job as a disc jockey there and used the studio to record a song of his own.
Broke the heart of my darling who loved me. Broke her heart and I know I done wrong. But I pray that someday she'll forgive me and remember when I've sang my last hillbilly song. When I've sang my last hillbilly song.
It wasn't much of a song, but the voice is recognizable. The record company he sent it to ignored it for a few decades, and Willie went on to DJ in Fort Worth next. From there, he drifted to Portland, Oregon, where he did more radio and gigged as a musician. Somehow, he came to the attention of Nashville songwriter May Boren Axton, who encouraged him to move down there, but he ran out of money on the road and wound up back in Fort Worth. There, he made a record for the Houston-based D Records label, which did well enough that he was allowed a second one. The label decided it wasn't country enough and refused to release it, so Willie and a friend released it under another name. It was the beginning of Willie Nelson, the songwriter.
Crazy, crazy for feeling so lonely. I'm crazy, crazy for feeling so blue.
that you'd love me as long as you wanted. And then someday you'd leave me for somebody new.
If anything would warn Nashville that this young songwriter wouldn't fit in, this was it. But Crazy has proven one of Willie's most durable songs, thanks to a country pop crossover by Patsy Cline. After Willie wrote a song called Family Bible and sold it for $100, and it became a smash country hit for Claude Gray, Pamper Music offered him a contract, and he moved to Nashville. Hit after hit for others followed. Nightlife, Hello Walls, Funny How Time Slips Away. Because he was such a valuable hit writer, record companies wanted him as an artist because the publishing deal they'd strike with him would mean income for their bigger stars. Finally, in 1964, he signed with Nashville's most prestigious label, RCA, but not much happened. He'd put together a band with some of his Texas buddies, Johnny Bush, Jimmy Day on steel guitar, and drummer Paul English. But as one of his most famous songs from these years shows, the road wasn't that much fun either.
It's been rough and rocky traveling, but I'm finally standing upright on the ground. After taking several readings, I'm surprised to find my mind still fairly sound. I guess Nashville was the roughest, but I know I've said the same about them all. We received our education in the cities of the nation, me and Paul.
In 1970, Willie's Nashville house burned down, and he moved to the hill country just outside Austin, Texas, more depressed than he'd ever been. A year later, he recorded The Words Don't Fit the Picture, an album so dark that it barely sold and has never been reissued.
If this is a game we play, and if this is a role I play, where are the words I say to you? The words don't fit the picture anymore.
Just when it seemed Willie had hit bottom, things turned around. He played a gig at an automobile dealership's opening in Austin and noticed hippies in the crowd. When the local psychedelic dance hall, Armadillo World Headquarters, asked him if he'd like to do a show, he agreed. Odd songwriters began approaching him with distinctly Texan songs they'd written and were performing in small local clubs. Willie had found his people, and in 1973, he celebrated the 4th of July with a small rock festival where a lot of these people played. His RCA contract ran out, and he signed with Atlantic Records, where he made a concept album, Phases and Stages, that was a masterpiece, but the record company closed its country division before it could become a hit. From there, he went to Columbia Records in 1975, and in a week, he recorded another concept album, Redheaded Stranger, which contained his first hit, Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain. Willie became famous, and the more famous he became, the fewer songs he wrote, which really was fine. Those songs had been unutterably sad, and now Willie Nelson was happy.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Today is Willie Nelson's 75th birthday.